From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Used to be the office was just another of the many settings for doing business alongside the storefront or the factory. But these days, the writer Nikhil Saval says the office has become the dominant workplace culture. In fact, he writes, "The United States is a nation of clerks." His new book is a history of how this happened, how the office evolved, and what the office is going to look like in the future. We've been tinkering with concepts and designs for decades, of course. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. The cubicle is a part of this history. The question at the heart of the book is, why, after all of our efforts, have we been unable to produce a happy environment for the American worker? The book is called Cubed, and we're talking about it after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There was a time when there was a kind of prestige in saying you were going to the office, but we're long past that as a country in many ways, even though most of us still work in one. Offices are portrayed in literature and popular culture as grim places with miles and miles of modular furniture drained of color and creativity. Our guest today, Nikhil Saval, says over the decades we've made attempts to fix these spaces, but most of the times we often created new problems. Saval has written a book that is about history, the history of the office, but it's also about design. It's about how we got to this point and why, after all of this effort, we still haven't been able to produce a truly happy environment for the American worker. This book is called Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Nikhil Saval is an editor of the literary magazine N+1. Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace is his first book. And he's joining us today from the studios of member station WHYY in Philadelphia. And Nikhil Saval, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's the most obvious question, I guess, and I'm sure you get it all the time. What got you thinking about a history of the office or all of this? Was it because you had spent some time in a, you know, soul-killing cubicle?
My first, it really was getting an office job that got me thinking about the office. It was, you know, I got a job straight out of college in a corporate publishing house named after a certain Antarctic species of tuxedo-colored animal. I don't want to indicate the name of the publishing house for fear of. But so I was working there. I had a very large, well-appointed cubicle by some standards. And, you know, I was very excited about it. I thought I was entering into kind of a universal possession of mankind. The ability to work into a cubicle was a great my experience that some millions had shared. And it was really, I think, when I moved offices, I moved to a new publishing house because I wanted sort of a better I was trying to get a better job. I had actually got a sort of more precarious situation, and my cubicle shrank. It was actually a workplace where I was understaffed, and I was working longer hours. And I kind of had a lot of nights and weekends alone in a cubicle.
Right.
And that's when I was like, well, why did this? What is the? It was this murky connection in my mind between these two things. And that's when I started doing some research, and it led me to. I was in the New York Public Library. And I pulled up this old pamphlet by Robert Probst, a designer, that was the original design for the cubicle.
Yeah.
And this was sort of the seed for the book when I saw this kind of this very revolutionary pamphlet announcing this design. That's where it all kind of came out of.
Did you conceive of it at that time? I mean, it's a working class history of the, I guess, what we would call the middle class. Is that what? Did you think it would become that when you got started?
I didn't necessarily. I mean, I didn't know it was so hard to know what it would be because I knew there was something to say about the office, but in a way that was part of the problem is that it was considered such a middle class space, the kind of traditional works that would treat the space didn't. You know, labor historians tended not to look at offices. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was some architectural history, but that wasn't really about the work. There was management theory, but that was always sort of a very literally top-down study of the work. And so it was sort of hard. I had to kind of create it from very many disparate sources. The one exception I will point out is women's history, that women's labor history is in particular much more attuned to this stuff than traditional kinds of history. So, yeah, it kind of came together, you know, and it was also the fact that my own experience working in an office, that was the thing I was most attuned to, was the sense of powerlessness that I felt in a workplace, that it was that I didn't really have, you know, labor unions, things like those sorts of things were the things that one associates with working class history. Were not only not very present in office, they weren't even conceivable in the late 20th, early 21st century. And so that was also part of it. Why that wasn't the case? Why it was one couldn't think of the office as working class was in some ways the problem I was trying to tackle.
Why do you figure, because you point this out early on in the book, that no one has really explored the history of the office in this way. You say maybe because it was, they figured it was kind of boring or it was uninteresting or something like that. But why do you figure we haven't really explored this before?
I mean, it's curious because you would think, I mean, based on, especially now in the, you know, where there's so much sort of television, right, let's say, or films, that popular culture recently that's been about office work. And maybe that's a sign that things are changing. But why it's been underexplored, I mean, I think, you know, part of it is that it was never, and this goes back to the very origins of the office, is that it was never really considered real work in a way. It was always, right. In some ways, it's parasitic on actually manual labor. It's you're not really producing anything. You're reproducing things. And the kind of predecessor book to which I'm paying homage is C. Wright Mills's White Collar from 1951. C. Wright Mills, the great American sociologist, and for him, you know, he pointed out that office work was in some ways the most alienated of working environments, because you weren't just alienated from a commodity, a physical product of labor, but you were alienated from sort of abstract work, mental work. You know, you weren't really in control of that.
Yeah,
and there's something about that makes it that is. I mean, I say this having now written a whole book about it. It's actually very hard to understand and look at closely. I mean, it's hard. People, even the kind of novels about work, rarely talk about the actual work that people are doing. It's very often about the kind of atmosphere of it.
But it seems like that, and this is an important theme, I think, throughout the book, this kind of contradiction that's going on, because you talk about how, you know, from the beginning, the office was always considered unworthy of its tasks, you know, business noble, but the office weak and empty. So there's this contradiction that seems to be like it's founded on those contradictions, I think is how you put it once.
Yeah, there's, you know, and this continues through the Joseph Schumpeter, the great, the kind of coiner of the phrase creative destruction, economist. He talks about how the sort of the entrepreneurial spirit that powered the United States or powered capitalism, it founders in the office in amidst all the columns of numbers. It suddenly feels unheroic. There's something about that. I mean, there's the fact that in the early offices, the early clerical offices of the 21st century. The 19th century, right. Mid 19th century. You have the fact that it is the place where business is transacted, where business is done, where, I mean, if you want to become a businessman, you know, it's the idea is that you enter as a clerk and you kind of make your way up a very short company ladder to become a partner. But there's something about that kind of apprenticeship or dependency that seems hostile to the ideal type of the entrepreneur, which is that you found your own concern. You know, you create your own business. So the idea of being an employee is it has that meritocratic idea, which is that eventually you'll make your way up. But it also seems so cowardly to a lot of people not to just kind of make your own way. But that's the problem is that becomes less and less tenable. The economy is not is not doesn't allow for that. You know, this is the kind of thing you have to do after a certain point in American capitalism.
Yeah. Well, it's become the dominant workplace. But it seems like we're returning to an idea. You talk about freelance culture and craftsmanship. And do you think we're coming back around to an older concept of what it means to work?
In some ways, I think that's true. I mean, certainly there's a lot of rhetoric around it. And I think a lot of – but, you know, I mean, which so – but, you know, some of it is real. I mean, I think in the sense that people who – you know, the ideal of the mid-19th century, and this is also the ideal that you find reiterated when business becomes big business, the hope is that somehow we can return to an ideal of craftsmanship or autonomy. But you have people who exit the labor force, in fact, one of them, and become freelancers. Mm-hmm. And partly because you're seeking some measure of control over it, what it is you do, whether that's temporally, you know, in just arranging your day in a way that you like, or you know, thinking about things in terms of projects. I think that's even true in the kind of more in the white collar workforce more generally. Hmm. That it's less people want to. There's a certain ideology around people work being results oriented, you know, and not sort of putting in time at the office. I mean, this is – one can exaggerate this. I mean, plenty of people, probably most, are still going 9 to 5 or more to an office every day, and they have to be in their chair. But, you know, I think that's definitely one of the ideals. That's one of the things that people, I think, are seeking when they choose to become freelancers or independent workers.
You talk about how, you know, we've been tinkering with this for a long time, but – here's how you put it early in the book. You say, why is it that these intentions of planners and designers have fallen short? Why is it that we haven't been able to produce a happy environment for the American worker? Is that an essential question that we ask ourselves that you're kind of getting at? Why can't we make this place, I guess, happy? Happy is the word you use anyway.
Yeah, I mean – happy, you know, it might not be the happiest formulation, but it's the idea I was trying to get at was, you know, the important part there one of the important parts is that designers, planners, management theorists, you know, and many workers themselves see the office as a place, as a place of freedom. Certainly, you could say that women in the early 20th century saw this, that when they went out to work, that this was, they were freed from the home. You know, there was something, there has always been this strange utopian content to the notion of office work that has maybe not, that, you know, may have accrued to certain kinds of manual labor in the 19th century, but quickly lost their sheen under the pressure of the assembly line. But the office retained it for many decades and, you know, arguably still does in certain respects. And the issue is why this existed at all, why people think work can be good at all. I mean, the other option would be to say, well, it's just work and it's not never going to be good. And the other thing is, like, if people had such good ideas, and I do think that many of these ideas are quite striking, and that you read over the kind of history of failed experiments and the cubicle being one of them, and you think, well, they had this, some of this seems like completely reasonable or quite visionary, but a lot of it seems to be it presumes to understand what office workers want, what they need, and where they what sort of work they should be doing, and so a lot of it is sort of imposed on them. So in a way, the question of why the environment is not happy or why it's not suited to the kind of work that people want or the kind of work that people want to do is also a question about power. And I think that was the kind of thing I wanted to get at by looking at design in particular, and you know why these things are imposed on people, how it is that they consent to them or not consent to them in certain respects. So that was those were the sorts of ramifications that I was looking at with that question.
Yeah, we'll come back to this too, but I was interested in that era of the sort of the .com. Time when there was all of these conversations about these novel workspaces, and there was this kind of, I think you put it this way in the book, this kind of enforced sense of just, we want you, we demand that you have fun. Like we demand that you get, you know, Nerf guns and that you go and play basketball. And it was but that wasn't any different than imposing any other kind of idea, that we were imposing, legislating this this kind of atmosphere. And it turns out that if you do it that way, it doesn't really work very well.
Yeah, it can often go wrong. I mean, one of the reasons that comes out is specifically with regard to the .com office is you have people who come out of, you know, other kind of gargantuan companies like IBM or Intel or what have you, and they come out of work environments that themselves were supposed to be revolutionary in their own way. And there's just a high level of churn at least in sort of the when the economy's good in Silicon Valley, things are turning over a lot. And so they just think like, well, I want it if I were to do it, if I were to do a workplace, here's how I would do it. Here's what I wanted as, say, an engineer or, right, you know, someone who with lots of talents. And then they impose it on sort of the next generation of workers. And it maybe works in a kind of smaller, they want to kind of preserve the startup nature, the very like all hours, just commitment, the fervor, the almost religious fervor for making this company work. And you try to preserve that as it gets bigger. And part of that is like enforcing this sense of company culture or fun, yeah, or what have you. And that cannot be received not very well, depending on how you do it.
Yeah. Nikhil Saval is with us. His book is called Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Nikhil Saval. We're talking about his book, which is a history of how the office came to be and where it might be going. It's called Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. So you write about the kind of earlier history of, beginning in the mid-19th century. And I guess in those days, I mean, they weren't really called offices, I guess. They were just these small spaces. I guess everyone has the image of Bob Cratchit when you think about those times. But give us a sense of the earliest moments, because you're really, in those days, you're working right alongside with the executive, right alongside with your boss. And as you put it, you can kind of see where you want to go. You can see your future.
That's right. So the mid-19th century, you know, the office, in a way, you could say it begins with paperwork. But the thing I locate in the mid-19th century is both the kind of growth of clerical work and these sort of small spaces. You know, at the time, they were mostly called counting houses. Mm-hmm. And they were the counting houses of partnerships. They were very small. But you have the growth of them in American cities. And then you also have the kind of recognition on the part of the workers themselves that they feel that, at least they express, that they belong to some kind of separate stratum of the workforce, and they start to develop institutions. And, you know, what you feel in these early offices is, one, they're of course very small, both in terms of numbers of people. There's usually one or two partners, two or three clerks, a bookkeeper, in a very crammed office, and then people kind of circling in and out of the space all day, including the clerks themselves. I mean, because all business is conducted face to face in those days, and what you have, the proximity between the clerk and the boss, that physical proximity, was also a kind of expression of just a temporal understanding that you, as a clerk, you saw where you would go, and it seemed quite plausible that that's where you might end up. I mean, it was not a perfect situation of upward mobility, but it was pretty good compared with later years, that you know, it seemed very normal that you would kind of work your way up, you would get, and then you were in this familial atmosphere. You, in a way, that the partner was often your, like, a kind of father figure, and you would eventually become the pater familias in a way of this firm, or you would become the partner if you did all the things that you were supposed to do. And I think the partners of the firm also expected that as well when they hired their clerks. So that was the kind of setting. I mean, that's a very maybe idealized portrait, but it seemed to be true of a lot of places.
Mm. And then there comes to be a kind of prestige associated with the office, which hits a kind of, I don't know if it hits a peak, but certainly things start to change once technology, the emergence of the machine starts to change this sense of prestige. I wanted to talk a little bit about the railroads because this is a major influence and I hadn't realized. In some way, it kind of creates a sense of our concept anyway of the office that we've come to know.
Right. So the railroads, I mean, one thing that they do very clearly is they change the scope of the economy. I mean, you know, there was so much that was local. Merchants exploited their kind of local control over, you know, regional markets. But suddenly those markets aren't regional when you can cross the country in a few days, you know, on a train. And so suddenly the trains they force that change in business. But then also the railroads themselves require a new kind of management structure. And so at least ideally, it wasn't always the case given, you know, in each situation, but their sort of organizational charts were very highly articulated. They developed this really long managerial structure. I mean, this is in a way where you start to see the emergence of things like middle management and even the term corporate ladder, or at least just a ladder to refer to the rungs of a corporate hierarchy, that comes into being around the late 19th, early 20th century. And it's in order in some ways to manage these just huge unwieldy enterprises that the railroads themselves and then the kind of larger trusts and just larger corporations that the railroads help emerge. And that's when you know you start to see also pyramids. I mean, in a way the pyramid is a better metaphor than the ladder because you have very few people at the top and suddenly a mass of people at the bottom. So it's no longer the familial environs of the counting house, the cheery counting house. It's now the vast caverns of the corporate office. And so you as a kind of clerk at the bottom, it's no longer quite as clear the path that you take to get to the top.
How does technology and just the emergence of a machine, how does that change the way we see office work? Because as you point out in the book, it gets less and less prestigious the more it becomes more – it's the office comes to look like a factory.
Yeah. So, I mean, things like – I mean, the typewriter is perhaps the most obvious version of this, but maybe the telegraph in a way as well, the various kinds of accounting machines, you know, the Burroughs adding machine is one of them, you know, and then even just the kind of mass production techniques that are not in the office, but the things that standardize office equipment, that makes so you're no longer working with sort of fountain pens, but you know, less more standardized tools. Your desks become standardized and metal furniture, things like that. It makes the whole office atmosphere quite more a lot more factory like. And this was actually somewhat intentional. The office designers didn't really have a sense of what offices that office work should look appreciably different or be different. I mean, so what you start to see is the emergence of offices that it's an outline that persists well into the 1970s. The kind of row after row of desks in the center of a giant office, and they're arranged simply in rows because just like a paperwork assembly line is how people thought of them. And there you find the so-called steno pool, a typing pool, often staffed mostly by women, or you might find an accounting pool, which is with adding machines, and it's arranged in such a way that in many offices that you kind of clock in and out as well, and you have a certain number of tasks to complete each day. It's very much, at least the ideal is that it's much more rationalized and in tune with the kind of just machinery of assembly work. Of assembly line work. So that's I think what the earliest machines do is they make it, you know, it makes it seem like the office, well, it should just be modeled like a factory. And they sounded like factories. If you went into a typing pool, I mean, they're incredibly, incredibly loud. I mean, their image, their kind of documentation of this in films at the time. And people visiting these places, they're just like, this just feels like this giant paperwork factory. So, yeah.
I wonder if, when does, do you get a sense in literature or in the journalism of, you know, I guess the earlier part of the 20th century, I suppose, where people start to question, where these ideas of these being mind-numbing places or soul-killing places, or, you know, when do we start seeing this appear in popular culture and literature, those kinds of things?
I mean, in a way, you might even say that it starts with things like Bartleby the Scrivener, where,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's that sort of early, the Herman Melville story, where it's just the endless copying of documents. And but I think the early 20th century, you know, there's a whole spate of novels and then also a handful of films that depict what was the, you know, major transformation, which was the entry of women into the office. And what they dramatize in a way is not just the kind of the what you might expect, which is the sexual politics that result from this, or the just the problem of, you know, finding a mate in the office, but also the conjunction of women with machines. And so you have, like, because women are almost invariably just assigned menial functions, typing, stenography. And so there's an early novel by the first American Nobel laureate for literature, Sinclair Lewis, called The Job, and where he refers to the vast, useless cosmos of offices and the kind of the just like the machine-like nature of the work that it was supposed to be freeing. I mean, and so there's a kind of contradiction in the fact that women enter the office expecting to, you know, achieve some measure of independence that they didn't have when they were confined to a domestic sphere, but then they actually become just enslaved to this, to the typewriter. And I mean, there was a point at which people would refer to women, they would refer to typewriters, and often they meant just women mm-hmm. who worked at typewriters, mm-hmm. that they became interchangeable, or type girls. I mean, these were, so yeah, I mean, I think that's when the sort of notion of the office as a kind of white collar sweatshop or drudgery, that kind of comes into being around that time, early 20th century.
When is it that designers start to take note? Start to think about, you know, because you have these design theorists who offer these different kinds of designs, trying to understand it all, trying to work around it. There are a number of these different ones. I'm not sure exactly where to start. They're in the 1930s, there's this style called an international style that emerges. Let's start there, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, so the international style, you know, people know it probably if they're familiar with architectural history a little, as the kind of, I guess you would call it, the kind of corporate expression of architectural modernism. You see these, it's, people might associate just the kind of the tall glass corporate towers of mid-century as expressions of the international style. I mean, it's associated largely with the French architect Le Corbusier. But then also others like Mies van der Rohe, Walter Gropius, a lot of European architects who end up in practicing in the United States. And, you know, in my interpretation, it sort of comes about as an attempt to a part of the larger psychological movement in workplaces, the human relations movement, which is the idea that workplaces should be designed in such a way as to make workers feel at one with their companies. The idea being that they should avoid forming labor unions. I mean,
right,
this is the 1930s, right?
Right.
And so, and that's very directly where the human relations movement comes out of. And international style architecture takes advantage of certain new technological developments to kind of make this happen. I mean, it's not always so explicit, but I think this is the kind of larger movement. And so one of the things is the development of the glass curtain wall, the ability to have like an exterior that is not made of masonry, you know, but actually just out of glass. So things like the UN Secretariat building, the Seagram building on Park Avenue, the Lever House, these are some of the most iconic versions of this. The other thing is the development of fluorescent lighting, of air conditioning. These allow buildings to be much deeper and larger and more energy efficient. I mean, it's cheaper to have fluorescent lighting, not necessarily more energy efficient to have air conditioning, but it's easy if you have glass, you can. And so that's when that kind of comes into being. And some of these are quite extraordinary, mm-hmm. these buildings. The Lever House, for example, it was it's still really a beautiful building. I mean, if you look on Park Avenue, it's this very thin glass slab, this kind of sea green curtain wall. It was designed for a soap company, so cleanliness was in some ways the symbolic value of this building. And it had lots of light. It was designed with the workers, the steno pool, in mm-hmm. mind. I mean, each desk was meant to have plenty of access to light, which was not mandated. I mean, the bigger these buildings got, the more likely it was that you might just get stuck in the middle of that building with no natural light. And this was an important development. The problem with the international style is it, in some ways, is very easy to be reproduced. I mean, for every Lever House or Seagram building, which were kind of considered expensive, you have a lot more speculative knockoff buildings, and they look kind of the same from the exterior, but on the interior, they're just really meant to be rentable. And so the kind of ideal of the gleaming corporate tower just becomes one more soulless box after another. And even, you know, figures like Mies van der Rohe at some point are just like, what went wrong? We had such high ideals. What went wrong?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Germany in the 1950s, there's this movement. I'm not even going to attempt the German name for it, but which essentially is the office landscape. And the idea is, as you've talked about, kind of leveling the hierarchies and opening up the floor. Talk about that part.
Yeah, so the German office landscape, a Bürolandschaft,
there
I think
go.
Might
yeah.
be the best approximation, is it comes out of, you know, the Germans in the 1950s, in a way they had been, thanks to the Third Reich, they had been preserved or they had been sheltered from a lot of American ideas, a lot of international ideas in general. And then it all comes kind of rushing in after the fall of the Third Reich. And management theory and what out of this ferment comes this idea that offices really need to be considered and planned out not with regard to hierarchy or to status, but with regard to paper flow and to work. I mean, you shouldn't get a corner office. The basic idea is like you shouldn't get a corner office just because you are high up in the company, you earned it, and you get a fancy desk. It's what do you need to do work? What is this whole organ, this organic thing called the company? What does it need to thrive? In a way, I mean, landscape is not such a bad, it's a literal translation, but in a way it was this kind of conceiving of the corporation as a kind of plant-like organism. Like, what does it need? What light does it need? How do you make it alive? And so they have these, like, if you look at the plans for it, it's just these kind of chaotic clusters of desks. They seem to have no rationale behind them, but invisibly tracing through these plans are just coursing lines of communication and paperwork. So the idea, it was the first open office plan, really. I mean, you weren't assigned a desk based on your level in the company. Everyone, at least initially, was supposed to have the same environment as anyone else, and the only thing that differentiated you was, you know, your team or what you had to do in the company.
Well, how do we get talk about the original cubicle? Because this comes from Robert Probst. You mentioned him before. He was this kind of he seemed kind of crazy. Brilliant, really. It had no training in design, but he was really interested in, I guess, as you talk about in the book, he was really interested in the way people work, how it is they work.
Yeah, Probst was one of the, I mean, in a way, like I said, he was the sort of seed for the book because he was such a kind of maniacally inventive figure. Mm-hmm. He was hired by the Herman Miller Company in the 50s to do, just because he was considered this kind of brilliant wacko who might do something for the company. And the first thing he got interested in was the office. And in a way, he came to the same conclusions that the designers of the German designers of the office landscape did, which is that offices as they had been conceived of were not suited to work. I mean, he came across the office as a factory. You know, he saw it and he was like, oh, they've just designed these office factories, but that's not good. That it's impossible to concentrate in these environments. It's impossible to get work done. He even called, he said the office is a wasteland. You know, it's it, for, that's the what he saw when he, in the early 1960s. And so he began to try to develop a kind of system based on his own experiments on himself, basically, and then some surveys to figure out a more humane environment for office workers, what he called knowledge workers at the time. And in fact, he's borrowing on the management theorist, Peter Drucker, who had just coined the term. And he, you know, he wanted the kind of figure in the center of the office to have as good an environment and as flexible and individualized an environment as the man in the corner office. So, you know, his first, his the thing that he came up with over many attempts was called the Action Office 2. There was a prior version that failed. And the emphasis was on action. He thought the office was about movement. And you were supposed to, it was this three-walled, obtusely angled, fabric-wrapped space that could be suited to any kind of environment that, you know, you needed in an open environment. He wanted it in some ways to divide up the office landscape. He was very enthusiastic about the open office. And it was, you know, the idea was that you would individualize it. There was shelving off the ground. You were supposed to, you know, move from space to space, standing to sitting. He was very prescient about the notion that you should stand a lot of the time while you worked. And it was a huge success. It debuted in 1968. You know, another kind of one of the more hidden revolutionary aspects of that year. And it had a kind of 60s element to it. He thought that it was very individualized. It focused on the individual, that space, much as, you know, sort of the new left or the hippies thought that the individual needed to kind of emerge and be more autonomous. And it was a huge success. People were like, why? How could we have ever worked in any other kind of office? You have just journalism, designers just thinking, this is great. And then other companies start to copy the design, other furniture companies. And it's in the copying and the reproducing that things start to go wrong. I mean, you have companies that start to realize that they don't really, I mean, the managers of these companies don't really care about Probst's sort of revolutionary ideas about the individual and autonomy and what have you. It's that they see this thing as being an instrument where you can cram as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, into as little space as possible, for as little money as possible. It suddenly becomes this thing that you can make into a box. And so they start to become more box-like. And by the late 70s, you have Probst writing these kind of panicked memos to Herman Miller, where he's like, "What? Something is happening to this design. We really need to reconceive it." And by then, in some ways, it's too late. And by that point, you know, it started to become recognizable as the office cubicle.
Yeah. It's detached from its meaning, detached from his principle anyway.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And, you know, the other kind of thing that happens in this is that the American economy undergoes this huge transformation in the 1980s. And there's another detachment that takes place, which is that it becomes associated with the era of mass layoffs and mergers. And so the cubicle, people start being shuttled into cubicles from their offices after a merger, or they're in a cubicle until they're laid off. I mean, this is a totally new, I mean, or, you know, a fairly new era of fear for the office worker, the late 80s, early 90s. And that's when, you know, 1989, the debut of Dilbert, at the bottom of that late 80s recession. And it's the cubicle is the symbol of transience, impermanence, precariousness. This was definitely not what Probst had foreseen for his design.
Nikhil Saval is with us. His book is called Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. We need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Nikhil Saval. We're talking about his book, Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. So you write about, we get to this movement that comes out in the mid-1990s, this idea of how you create an informal office environment. And there's this one of the leaders of this is a man named Tom Peters. And then you see this kind of company culture that emerges, this idea we were talking about earlier, kind of this enforced sense of fun. And then there's this question of how can we make this more organic? You know, how does this, you know, how do we design all of this? But you write about, and I wanted to talk about what you identify as kind of one of the most audacious experiments of this era. And this happens on a ski slope. A man named Jay, is it Chiat?
Yeah, Chiat, I think it's it. Yeah.
Yeah, Jay yeah. Chiat. He has this realization. He's this really intense guy who's the head of this very successful advertising agency. And he's skiing up at Telluride, in Telluride, Colorado. And he has this kind of moment of inspiration, and he conceives this plan. Talk about this story.
So Jay Chiat was the head of one of the most storied advertising firms, Chiat Day. It still exists. It's now TBWA Chiat Day in the early 90s. And he was sort of, you know, you see these figures a lot in these sort of storied companies, these megalomaniacal figures. Mm. Steve Jobs is another one. These people who are constantly dissatisfied, constantly upset at their employees, about their companies, and constantly trying to revolutionize them or just revamp them in some way. And Chiat, you know, his company had created a lot of very iconic ads. The Energizer Bunny ad had been one. The famous Apple ad, the 1984 ad, where they someone throws a hammer through the IBM screen during the Super Bowl. But the company was kind of not doing so well in the early 90s. And Chiat came to this realization that he felt that one of the things that he could do to shake up his company was to shake up the office. He was sort of an early enthusiast of some of the potential in technology, in laptops, the sort of what now feel like very rudimentary laptops, in more mobile phones, certain kinds of telecommuting. I mean, these things are becoming more and more prominent in the 90s, of course. And Chiat, one thing he's also hostile to is the same thing that Probst or the office landscapers or any people in the history of the office were often hostile to. And it was the hierarchy, the sense that you needed to be in a private space that was your own and just hide out from people. He thought that offices should be more like campuses or universities, you know, you're more collaborative and not based on, you know, where you just kind of disappear into your cubbyhole and you know, don't interact with people. And the other problem, of course, is that Chiat was sort of a one-man show. He wanted to do this his own way. And so he in the 90s, I guess 1993, he announced his plan, which was to change the Chiat Day offices to a what has been called a non-territorial office. Mm-hmm. You would no longer have your own desk. You would no longer have your own space at all. You would come into the office. You would get a laptop and a phone, and you would have a locker, and basically you would find a place to work, and that would be your day. Mm-hmm. You know, and this was in a way, this is not probably some people actually work in offices that are not dissimilar at this point, but in this early time, this was seen as one of the most astonishing things that anyone could propose. It was very widely reported. It was breathlessly reported in some ways. It's just the future of the office. And so it you know, Chiat put it into motion, and their offices were in Los Angeles, and it very, very quickly became a huge disaster. Yeah. Some of the best reporting I should point out on it was done by Wired magazine, which was interesting because Wired was also a huge enthusiast for the dot-com yeah. era. But it was very sober about this. You just had one of the things is that it just all went wrong. I mean, people had no, you know, there weren't enough laptops, there weren't enough phones. If you came in late, you might not get it. The lockers sort of made people felt like it was high school. People couldn't find the right place to sit. There was this famous image, or it became famous from this story, of one woman walking around with a toy wagon like a kind of red wagon, wheeling her stuff around, looking for a place to sit where she could get work done. It was impossible to concentrate because it was a sort of open plan setup. People would start taking phone calls in their cars. They would come early and stash a laptop in their locker and then leave and then come back later. I mean, it was just like, it was a kind of War of the Worlds like chaos, except the problem was not really that the workers were you know, incapable of handling this revolutionary idea, but that it had completely been imposed on them. And Chiat, you know, surveying the wreckage, eventually, you know, they moved into a different office setting that was more traditional, at least in terms of assigning people workspaces. He felt like this revealed the kind of inadequacy of human nature, human beings just being unsuited. They were so concerned with prestige and status. They needed their own offices. They were so unused to what his sense of like just this anarchic democracy that they were not ready for him in a way, and they were not ready for his vision. But probably the real answer is that he had no idea what he, you know, he had in some ways just imposed this rather uncompromising vision on a group of people and had not adequately prepared them for it, whether in terms of resources or just psychologically. And that it was one of the great failures in the kind of history of the office and the future in the office design.
Yeah. But what's interesting about that story, I think, is that on some level he had gotten things right. They just didn't get the design right. And so they rework it. I mean, Jay Chiat is no longer around, but his headquarters now, designed by this architect, Clive Wilkinson, he's an interesting character as well. He kind of goes in the opposite direction of Chiat's original idea, as opposed to this, you know, nomadic existence, as you put. He comes up with an office that's designed, thoroughly designed as any workplace has ever been, almost. And in some way, I guess, is this what – it's not exactly what we've ended up with, but is this where we are in some way right now with this kind of idea, really thoroughly designed?
Yeah. And well, certainly this is one of the trends, I'd say. I mean, their office seems to be going in all kinds of directions, yeah. And this is one of the most famous ones or sort of most recognized ones, which is the office that is self-contained and kind of – and sort of urban in its way. You know, so Clive Wilkinson's design for what is now TBWA Chiat Day, actually people probably have seen it if they've seen the show Silicon Valley on HBO. The offices of the fictional company Hooli are actually these very offices. It's this warehouse in Playa del Rey in Southern California. And it has this central street running through it. It has a basketball court. It has an indoor park. It has it's a very large, kind of breathtaking, I have to say, when I first saw it, building that. And it does design it has a huge variety of spaces. I think that was one of the ideas that Chiat had originally missed. And you know, some of them allow for privacy. Some of them are for collaboration. If you're sort of lower on the company, you might get a private space. It's usually meant to, you know, that you may actually need a private space for the kind of work that you're doing. So, and the other idea is that you're meant to spend a lot of time there. It's meant to recreate the kind of pleasures of city life. I mean, that you might go there on a weekend and have and blow off steam by playing, you're working on a weekend, so you have to blow off steam by playing this sweaty game of basketball. Mm-hmm. And then you go get a sandwich from the panini bar, and then you kind of are just there, and then you hang out in the park, right, indoors all the time. I mean, it's a little bit, I mean, you know, some people might find it a little bit dystopian in the sense that it's like, well, it's in a city, right? I mean, why, it's in Los Angeles, why aren't they just enjoying themselves? And, you know, it's a pretty nice, the weather's pretty nice, weren't they outside? Or, you know, but the idea is that you're more productive when you're kind of, at least the rhetoric there is that you're more productive when you're kind of on campus, when you're sort of there all the, when you're there and you're you know, and you're collaborating or what mm-hmm. have you. And this is, you see this rhetoric also associated with places like Google or Facebook, where they have similar and even probably grander attempts to make your these offices self-sufficient. You could go to the doctor if necessary, you know, and some of these places, you they have like resistance pools at Google and Mountain View. I mean, there's just, you know, there's a lot more to do, and there's a lot less reason to leave.
It's interesting. We didn't get to a lot of these different, these newer trends in working, co-working, the idea of redesigning cities, not just offices as well, a lot that we didn't get to. But let me ask you this finally, about a minute left. You say flexibility is a tool and it's an opportunity. And in the end, you say it's really up to office workers themselves to sort of try to make this freedom meaningful. Is that one of the takeaways, that that it's up to us to also figure out how we can make the office work?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things you see over and over is this notion that office workers are not in somehow the agents of their own destinies. They're not the agents of their own workplaces. And this is often why things have gone wrong, is that things are imposed on workers. It's the power of workers is very sharply curtailed. Mm-hmm. And flexibility is another one of these opportunities, in a way, where people might, you know, it's seen as this thing where you can, by making workers flexible, by making labor markets flexible, you make workers disposable. You make them, it increases their sense of powerlessness. But there is a kind of freedom to be sought here. And so I think some way, a sense of organization, let's say, like where workers are able to like to create a real sense of organized power, I think that might be the way that we see real autonomy, we see real freedom in workplaces. And so that's where we have to look, is workers declaring autonomy en masse, you know, and not just as freelancers, not just as individuals, but as in some kind of organized, maybe unionized fashion. I think that's where the workplace can really change.
It's Nikhil Saval. His book is called Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Joined us from member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks very much for the time.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.